MacCast, Saturday, January 11th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We have another great week of Apple Mac news, tips, rumors, all sorts of things to talk about. Specifically, we're going to get into some details surrounding the Mac Pro. A lot more information is coming out now that people are getting those in their hands. We've discovered some very interesting things about the upgradability of the Mac Pro. Also, is this the year of the post-PC? When post-PC, Tim Cook's prediction really takes off. There seems to be some numbers, although they're in a bit in dispute, some numbers indicating that we're in very heavy transition over to the post-PC era. We've got a lot of rumors about the next version of the iPhone, and also a new beta of iOS 7 came out over the past week. That and a whole lot more in the news. Plus, we've got all kinds of tips and hints and tricks to talk to you about. Specifically, I have a great question from a listener about Thunderbolt GPUs and doing Thunderbolt expansion of your graphics processor. So we're going to dive into that topic a little bit. Also, some Apple TV tips and how to fix those software updates that seem to keep getting stuck in the Mac App Store. That and a whole lot more. Bunch of great stuff to talk about. But before we get into that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Gazelle.com. You can head there and you can get cash for your old iPhones, iPads, Macs, even other devices, Android devices, things like that. And they make the process so easy. A lot of people will often ask me why I like Gazelle so much, and it's because I like an easy process. I like knowing everything up front, how much I'm going to get for a product, knowing that it's handled, the transactions handled safe and securely and reliably, and they've just always done such a great job. They make the process, I don't think they could make it easier, because all you have to do is go over to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You do a quick search to find your item. They also have a bunch of the most popular items right there up front. So if it's an iPhone, you just click on your iPhone model. You tell them a little bit about which one you have, which version, how much storage, what kinds of conditions it's in. They walk you through the process, ask you a few questions. They'll even buy broken devices, so you don't should go there even if you have a broken device and see if you can get an offer for that. And then once you've completed that process, they give you a risk-free offer right there on the screen. They even have free shipping, and in some cases, they'll even send you a box. I did that the last time I sold them iPhones, and they sent me the boxes. I wrapped everything up and shipped it back, and then once they get your devices, they look it over. They'll wipe and clean off all the old data. They'll take care of that for you if you'd like, and then you get paid fast by cash, by check, or by PayPal. Or you can even get 5% more on your offer if you opt to get paid by an Amazon gift card. So they just make everything fast, getting paid fast. They make it easy and convenient, taking care of your data. And they've paid out over $100 million to over 600,000 customers. So it's safe and secure. You don't have to worry about some of the hassles and just the concerns that you might have by selling your old devices through other mechanisms. So if you haven't given them a shot, you really should. Head over to gazelle.com now to get an offer on your old iPhone, iPad, or Mac. And don't wait, because the longer you wait, the more, as new devices come out, the more devices will lose value over time. So you want to sell them sooner than later, and you can check it all out. And it's really just a really great service. I love Gazelle. Gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. And so, speaking of getting rid of some of your older products, specifically your Mac, and moving over to the new hotness, the Mac Pro is out. People are slowly, I guess I should say it's out, kind of. It's trickling out there. Those people who pre-ordered them very, very early on are starting to get them. They're still pretty hard to come by, but wow, that thing is a beautiful, screaming, awesome machine. And the reviews that are coming in are just outstanding on the new Mac Pro. People are completely blown away, not only by the design, but also by just the performance, the raw performance that is being eked out of them. And I don't even think all the software out there is fully optimized for them yet, but very, very impressive. And apparently there are now floor models available in there to look at least. I shouldn't say available. There are floor models in the Apple retail stores that you can go in and check out. I have not had an opportunity to make my way into a retail store to see one yet. And I'm looking to do that hopefully in the next week or two. I'll give you my impressions on a future episode, but several of you have emailed in to say you had a chance to look at them, and I think there was a lot of drooling going on. Apple probably has to keep a little towel over by the table to mop that stuff up. But the retail stores are reportedly actually not going to have units to sell in store until March or April. So you can just kind of go and look, but you can't buy quite yet. Well, actually, you can order online. They're telling customers to go direct online, order through the online store, and you can get them shipped that way. Shipping estimates right now for the U.S. are in the February time frame. And if you do order online, you can have it shipped to an Apple retail store for pickup. I'm not sure why you'd opt for that versus having it shipped to your home. Maybe if you're out during the day and you just want to make sure it arrives safely. But supposedly, they're screaming fast, super quiet. I've had a lot of people comment that when they go in to look at it, they have to like literally put their face up to the vent before they can even hear the fan. So right down near the top of it. And I guess there's just a nice little warm current of air coming off the top of them as they're running. But I'm looking forward to getting my eyes on one pretty soon. But the big news that happened over the past couple weeks was that we started getting the teardowns. So Otherworld Computing tore one down and iFixit tore one down. And they started looking at the guts and seeing what made the thing up. And they discovered something highly unusual, something you wouldn't have expected for a design that's that compact and small. And that is that they're pretty upgradable as far as Macs go. You know, the MacBook Pros, pretty much you can maybe change the RAM if you're lucky in some of the models, but you can't really get in there and do much beyond that. You know, the flash storage is soldered on there. And so it was surprising that the Mac Pro actually, one, it opens up really easily. There's a little sort of toggle switch, and you unlock the switch on the side of the case, and you pull the aluminum shell off, and then you have access to the guts in there. And then once you're in there, the RAM is right there, immediately accessible and replaceable. So that's really, really easy to do. The SSD, which is on the back, I think, of one of the Fire Pro graphics cards, the little connector for it, is actually a socketed connector, a slot, I guess I should say. And there's just one screw at the top that you unscrew, you undo that, and the whole SSD module, or flash module, I guess I should say more accurately, will come out. And OWC, apparently at CES this past week, already had some prototype cards that should work in the Mac Pro for future upgrades. So those will be available. I think it's kind of, it's a non-standard connector. I think some of the PC manufacturers are using a different kind of connector for their flash SSD drives, storage cards, but Apple has their own. But apparently OWC, as they've done in the past with the MacBook Pros and things like that, do have a version that will work in the Mac Pros. And then most surprisingly, it was discovered that the CPU is socketed. So you technically should be able to replace the graphics card, the CPU, the processor. And as a matter of fact, OWC figured out that they were able to do it. It's an LGA 2011 socket R CPU socket, so standardized socket. Of course, it's not officially supported by Apple, and it probably never will be, and it could and probably very most likely is warranty voiding to replace the processor. But you know, several years from now, when your Mac Pro is starting to show its age — it certainly doesn't show its age right now, but when it is, it's nice to know that you might have the option to update the CPU. And like I said, OWC already attached and benchmarked three different Intel Xeons in the Mac Pro that they had. They tried out a 6-core Intel Xeon E5 1660 version 2 running at, or V2 running at 3.7 gigahertz. They also did an 8-core model, that's the E5 2667, and a full 10-core Intel Xeon E5-2690. I don't think you can get off-the-shelf commercially the 12-core Xeon processor that Apple sells on the top-of-the-line Mac Pro. And as a matter of fact, I think all the Xeons that are in the Mac Pro are specifically model numbers or units that are not available commercially. But these are the commercial processors, Intel Xeons, available from Intel. And OWC tried them all out. And the multi-core Geekbench score on the 10-core upgraded system came very close to the same kinds of Geekbench scores we were seeing on the 12-core version from Apple, something in the 30,000 range. And they have details on their website and their blog if you want to go check that out at MacSales.com. I think it's MacSales.com/blog. But here's the deal, is that those processors, even though you can upgrade them right now, they're still pretty pricey. That 6-core Intel, that's going to run you $1,300 just for the processor. The 8-core model, and this was weird, the 8-core model seems to be priced higher than the 10-core. I'm not really sure why. The 8-core, $2,700 to $3,000 when I was looking online for that processor, and the 10-core processor is $2,200. So even if you opted to go with the base model Mac Pro, which I think Apple sells for $3,999 US or $2,999 US, so $3,000, you're going to be adding another $2,200 just to get the 10-core processor if you want to swap out the processor. So right now, I don't think it's very cost effective to do the upgrades on your own. You might save a little bit money in the end, something like $500, but then you're going to have an unsupported system and you're going to be dealing with all kinds of probably quirks and things like that, and having to tweak it to make it work. So you're probably better off just getting it, in my opinion, direct from Apple at this point. But this is more about future-proofing, right? You now know that you potentially could swap out with the next generation or third or fourth generation of these processors, you know, several years from now. And we also got some cool other design and technology details from the disassemblies. One, it was discovered that the antenna system is inside the top of the cooling fan. So when you pull that cooling fan assembly off, up in the top of that, it has the entire antenna system for the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth, as well as the airport card that sits inside of that mechanism as well. And when they opened it up, it's got this really cool looking gold-plated antenna on there. It looks pretty heavy duty from the images that I saw. And the airport card looks pretty standard. It's got the standard slot and looks like it would also be easily replaceable in there. The port assembly, which is actually on the back of the power supply, is all contained on a single card. So on the back of the unit, you know, when you turn it around, you've got all your Thunderbolt and FireWire, or Thunderbolt and HDMI, excuse me, and USB ports and Ethernet and all that good stuff. That is all contained in a single unit. That's, I guess, a little bit of a disadvantage, because if you lose a port, something happens, you're going to be replacing that whole entire board. I don't know that it's been that different in other models, but it was something pointed out by iFixit when they were doing their teardown review. The Mac Pro uses 68% less power than the previous Mac Pro, and also 82% less packaging. That came out from some of the details Apple published on its environmental responsibility site about the new Mac Pro. So significant power savings with the smaller design. I'm sure having, you know, the pure flash storage and all those other things is going to help a lot in terms of power consumption. And Apple also came out and with an article mentioning that the Mac Pro can be mounted on its side. So typically when we've seen it in images, it's designed to sit vertically. There's air intakes on the bottom and it sort of sucks air through up through the cooling mechanism, which is in the center of the Mac Pro, and blows it out the top. But you can actually put them on their sides. The article on Apple's website is actually very, very interesting because they mention, well, if you're going to put it on your side, its side, make sure it doesn't roll away, so secure it. And also, you're going to want to put, you know, some sort of protective material down. So if you're setting it on a desk, you don't want it to get scratched up, that beautiful new highly polished. It's a really highly polished aluminum finish. I know from a lot of the images on Apple's website, it looks like it's black, but it's actually kind of this graphite dark silver gray color. I think, again, I haven't seen one in person. Maybe it's going to, I have this feeling when I see it in person, it's going to be a bit shinier and a bit brighter than it is even alluded to in some of the images that I've seen online. But if you do side mount them, you can kind of rack them up in server applications. If you want to build out a server farm, I would think that would be the typical application. I think we're going to see some really cool third-party racks and systems for like putting these together. I can't wait to see just in a giant rack with these things all lined up. I have a feeling it's going to look like a wine cellar or like a brewery or something with all these little canisters, one right after the other. But Apple does warn that if you are going to do that, you want to have some distance between them because, again, that venting that comes out, you don't want the venting from one sort of overheating another one. And they specifically mention that you don't want to stack them sort of end-to-end like a big long tube with the intake of one fan blowing into the, or with the outtake of one fan rather blowing into the intake of another fan. That would not be good at all for cooling. But the Mac Pro looks very, very cool. If you've received one and want to share with us some of your first impressions, what you're actually doing with it, sort of the things that you're seeing performance-wise, I'd love to get a little quick audio review. Just shoot that along, maccast@gmail.com. And maybe even if someone has one, we can get them on Skype and do a quick little interview. If you'd be interested in that, again, email me and let me know. I think that if you talk to most people, they will tell you that we are quickly moving into this post-PC era that Tim Cook talked about a few years back. And I think, in my personal opinion, 2013, 2014, I think we're going to look back and see these as kind of the crossover years, the years where things kind of went toward the post-PC more than desktops and notebooks and stuff like that. Those things aren't going away, and I don't think anybody's arguing that, but I think what we're seeing is that consumers are more and more flocking to tablets and smartphones and using other devices for doing a lot of their computing tasks, and that's going to just continue to happen more and more. We've been seeing these numbers of declining desktop and notebook sales for a while, but this week there were some numbers out from NPD that looked to be a little bit confusing. It looked like the trend might even be going the other way because they published this note on U.S. tablet and notebook channel sales, basically on computer device sales for 2013, looking at everything that we would consider to be a computing device, be it a tablet or a notebook. I don't think smartphones were included in these numbers. And in looking at their numbers, things looked pretty rosy for most devices, including desktops and tablets, almost everything except Apple's desktops and notebooks. It kind of had this very negative Apple slant to the numbers when you looked at them. They weren't implying that, but they were just reporting the numbers and looking at the percentages and how they were displaying them. It did not look very good for Apple's lineup. In essence, NPD said that 14.4 million desktop notebooks and tablets were sold through U.S. commercial channels, and that was a 25.4% increase over 2012 numbers that they had. They said desktop sales were up 8.5%, notebook sales 28.9%, and tablet sales a massive 49%. So that's where you can kind of see that post-PC piece factoring in. But the report also said that Apple's notebook and desktop channel sales combined fell by 7%. And the headline that came through on most of the reports were that there was huge growth for both Android tablets and Google Chromebooks, both combined selling 1.76 million units, and that was up from 400,000 units last year. So that's a huge increase. As a matter of fact, they said that Google's Chromebook accounted for 21% of all notebook sales. So just in terms of raw sales numbers, things are looking up, right? We're selling more devices, more notebooks and tablets than we were in 2012. But that's generally a natural progression. Where the post-PC indications come into play was when they started breaking it down by what kinds of devices were being purchased year over year. So in looking at the desktop breakdown, desktops were at 27.8% of all computing devices. That was actually down from 32.3%, so a big drop in desktops. Windows notebooks, 34.1%, down from 42.9% share last year. Apple's notebooks were at 1.8%. That was down from 2.6% of the overall share last year. The Chromebook, according to their numbers, was up massively, 9.6%. Up from just 0.2% of the market last year. And iPads were down 15.8%, down from 17.1%. They still accounted for 59% of the total volume in the tablet market, according to the NPD study, but down. Android tablets were up 8.7% of the market from 4.2% last year, and Windows tablets were up pretty big, 2.2%, but they only, you know, with 2.2% share, excuse me, and that was up from 0.8% in 2012. So everybody pretty much going up except desktops and notebooks, all down. Chromebooks and Android tablets, according to their numbers, looked like they were hugely successful, like they grabbed a lot more market share. But you start thinking about these numbers and you think about if you live in the real world, like we all do, they don't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Apple sells a lot of notebooks. They sell a lot of tablets. You know, something's going on here, and it didn't smell right to our friend Ken Ray either. And he did some digging that I think a lot of the others didn't. So these numbers were reported all over the place. And the gist of what you need to know, go listen to Ken's show. I think it was back on at the end of December. But the gist you need to know about is the details behind the numbers. That's the key to this whole thing, specifically the wording. And the NPD study was on commercial channel sales. And I don't know what that necessarily means. I don't know if many of us do. What commercial means is that they were looking at numbers of units sold to businesses. Well, right away, we know that Apple has a smaller percentage share of the business market. So that's one factor that goes into this thing. Also, channel. That word channel is key. Channel sales are sales that are done through third party, i.e. not direct sales. And a huge part of Apple's business is actually direct sales. Apple sells direct to consumers. They sell, of course, through channel, but that's not the major portion of their business. So it didn't count any of that stuff. It also didn't count any made-to-order machines. These were just stuff that's off the shelf. You can walk into Best Buy or wherever and purchase. And it was stuff like that sold to business consumers. So seeing a trend in businesses buying Chromebooks is still very, very interesting, but trying to compare Apple's share of the market versus others really is saying not a lot. It doesn't really tell us a whole bunch of stuff. Apple has its own direct-to-business sales, and those machines and devices aren't counted in NPD's numbers. And to be fair to the tablet and PC manufacturers, they also sell direct, but again, for Apple, it's a much larger part of their business, I think, compared to other ones. So really the lesson in looking at these numbers is we always need to kind of understand what we're talking about and never take any one of these blog posts or analyst numbers just on sort of faith or off of the headline. And it's really easy to do. You see these headlines, oh, Chromebook sales are massive. You know, they're rising up massively based on these NPD numbers. Well, they are in one context, in one perspective, but that may not be saying a whole lot. And unless you know and take the time to know and get an understanding of what you're actually looking at, and again, assuming you even care about this junk, then you kind of can't just take these numbers on faith, and you've got to really pay attention. And I know I was thrown off by this. I thought, wow, this is really, really surprising and shocking, and it was great when Ken gave that explanation. And actually, a couple other sites came out later and sort of broke down and explained these numbers, and that's how I found out about all this stuff. But I wanted to make sure that I shared it with you, because it's easy to get distracted. And despite any share numbers, you know, Apple still sells a heck of a lot of Macs. And I think as Mac fans and watchers of at the Apple and Mac universe, we need to kind of pay attention to that more than maybe some of these other sorts of things. And Gartner says that Apple's fourth quarter Mac sales are probably going to be up about 28.5% year over year, at least in the US. Again, worldwide, Apple does a little bit less well as than they do in the US, and that's for like a lot of their products, and a lot of for a lot of different factors, right? Price point, in emerging markets, Apple tends to sell less units and things like that. But for Apple, having sales 28% up 28% year over year for desktops and notebooks, that's a pretty big deal, especially when you compare it to the rest of the PC industry, which is expected to see a drop about 7.5% over the same period. So Apple is still doing very, very well on desktops. They're percentage-wise, they don't sell as many, right? We know that, as PCs, but they're still seeing a rise in their sales year over year, which is a good trend, right? So I was trying, when I'm looking at these numbers, to think about trends. You know, the trend of Chromebooks selling more in commercial environments. That's very interesting. The trend of Apple continuing to increase and sell more Macs. That's a very, very good thing for us as Mac and Apple fans. So try and focus on those numbers and not get too distracted by shares and percentages. And again, another big number, I think, where Apple always excels is on profitability. I was reading some reports this week that I think one site said the average profit margin on a desktop PC sale is somewhere around $15 a unit. And I can't imagine trying to make a living off of a business where you're selling something that sells for even $200, $300, $400, and you're only making $15 a unit. That's, you got to sell a lot in volume to make up any kind of profit, especially if you have a lot of overhead and marketing and advertising and stuff like that. So I don't envy being a PC manufacturer, and I don't think Apple does either. That's why I've always said I don't think they pay much attention to what the competition is doing. They're more focused on making their products the best products that they can be, and also increasing Apple's bottom line. And if they're making a profit and selling more machines and their customers are happy, I think Apple's happy. And you know, that's the way I sort of look at it. Of course, it is 2014, and it's time to start firing up the rumor mill for the next round of Apple products. It looks like first on the block is going to be the iPhone 6. We've been seeing a lot of rumors. Of course, we had rumors last year as to what Apple's next phone would be like, although we didn't even get an updated iPhone or updated iPhones with the 5S and 5C till the end of the year. So it seemed like we were waiting all year for and having rumors of both the current generation or the next generation phones, and then what's going to be even on further on the horizon. But this time around, we're getting a lot of rumors about the iPhone 6. A Chinese social network, Weibo, claims that that some unnamed Foxconn executives said Apple is going to make a quote-unquote one-time exception and launch two different iPhone screen sizes this year for the iPhone 6 that will see a 4.7-inch model as well as a 5.7-inch model coming out. Last year, we had been sort of hearing that Apple is going to finally do a larger screen iPhone. There's been a lot of debate about what size it's going to be. I will say this Weibo blogs, you know, social network, Chinese social network source is going to have to be taken with a grain of salt. It seems a little bit sketchy, but it is mirroring some reports we have heard from some other sources, places like the Wall Street Journal. They've said that Apple is testing iPhone designs with screen sizes up to 6 inches, so falls right in that 5.7-inch range. And KGI security analyst Ming-Chi Kuo also said that Apple was looking to make a phone with a 4.5 or 5-inch display, so that falls in line with that 4.7-inch model. And I still don't know how I feel about a larger screen iPhone. The one thing about this rumor that I find really odd is I do not think Apple's going to do two screen sizes. It's just typically not in Apple's DNA to have that kind of choice. I could see them doing that if maybe they're looking to increase the size of both the iPhone 5C line and the iPhone 5S line, so that maybe the consumer level lower price model is going to be a 4.7 and the Pro higher end model is going to be a 5.7-inch. But I would be bummed by that a little bit, because I want the next generation, you know, iPhone 6 or 6S, whatever it's going to be, but I don't want a 6-inch screen on my phone. So maybe that's why we'll end up with two sizes. Who knows? But it could be a very interesting year if Apple does decide to go that route. Korea's ET Times says that the new phone is going to be significantly thinner, just 6 millimeters, and that they are even calling it an iPhone Air. I don't know if that's just them or if that's officially what Apple might be referring to the next generation Pro iPhone or iPhone 6 as. The piece also claims that Apple will be reducing the price of the iPhone 5S this May by $100. I don't know if that would be in anticipation of the iPhone 6 coming out or just trying to keep sales going through the middle part of the summer. I would expect that Apple's going to stick to their release cycle. We haven't heard any reports of that, but I have a feeling Apple's going to continue to release new iPhone updates in the fall. So I don't expect us to see an iPhone 6 until the September, October, November timeframe. So we have a lot of time to talk about these rumors. Some of the other things that we're hearing with regard to an updated iPhone, it may potentially have a curved display. I think we talked about that a little bit last year. And there was also a rumor this week that Pegatron might get up to half the orders for production of iPhone 6 models. This comes from Taiwan's Liberty Times. Some think that the production may be split, that the production split may be another indicator that we are going to see two different models that, you know, may Pegatron would be producing one model and Foxconn might be producing a different model. And by different models, I mean these rumors are pointing to the fact that it would be one model, two different screen sizes. So iPhone 6, 4.7, 5.7, or what have you. I still maintain, again, that it could just be that there's going to be Pegatron producing the iPhone 5C updated model, which I think they are doing a lot of the iPhone 5C production now, if not all of it, and that Foxconn would continue to do the the higher end version of the iPhone, so the replacement for the iPhone 5S. And that seems more likely to me, but that's not what these rumors are indicating. They're indicating the next generation iPhone, the replacement for the iPhone 5S, would be two different models or two different screen sizes, one model. Now, one thing I think you can be sure of, though, is that the iPhone 6 is not going to replace their Touch ID with a Retina scanner, something that supposedly Samsung is looking into for its next generation Galaxy, the Galaxy S5 model. I think the CEO or president of Samsung was talking to one of the blogs. I can't remember if it was Engadget or The Verge, somebody like that, and they said that they are looking into retinal scanners for their phones. I'm not really sure that I'd want to be sticking my phone into my eye, you know, my phone into my eye every time I want to be able to unlock it. That doesn't make any sense. And this is what constantly gets me about Samsung, is they have these technologies, cool technology. I mean, retina scans, come on, how sci-fi is that? But the application of it, the execution of it, does it make sense for that kind of device? You know, they went through that whole round of, hey, you can have touch without having to touch your device, you know, gestures without having to touch your device. Never made sense to me. This is another one of those things. This is like, can you imagine driving and you need to unlock your phone? You got to hold it up to your face. That's not going to fly over very, very well. I mean, what's nice about a touch sensor or a fingerprint scanner is it's very natural. You're holding your phone, you stick your finger on it, and it unlocks. Holding a camera up to your eye, I guess if it works from a fairly good distance, but I have never seen a retinal scanner that doesn't work by actually just, you know, sticking your eyeball right onto, almost onto the sensor, or very close to the sensor. So I don't know. It's just weird. You don't want a retinal scanner in your iPhone 6, do you? I think it's something more for your front door than your phone. But maybe that's just me. I do think that Apple will continue to expand their Touch ID technology, though, and I fully expect that to show up in the next generation iPad. But that's sort of what's going on with the iPhone 6. One thing that I heard that was very surprising about the next generation iPhone is that it might not have an upgraded camera, at least in terms of the megapixel. You know, we continually see camera upgrades in iPhones, but once again, it's sounding like Apple might focus on areas outside the actual megapixels in the sensor. And I would have thought that the iPhone is kind of due for a megapixel upgrade. We've had the 8-megapixel sensor in there for a while. Some of Apple's competitors are going to 12, 16, even higher. The Nokia phones, geez, they have, you know, 21, 41 megapixel, whatever they're throwing in there, just cramming in the megapixels. I've never been a big believer in the megapixel race, and I don't think Apple is either, but it just seems like a natural progression to sort of bump it up a few extra megapixels. It would let you do larger images. I don't think it adds to the quality, or it makes a huge difference in terms of the quality of the images. And I think that's what Apple's responding to by keeping at 8 megapixels. But You know, people like to be able to have bigger images, be able to blow them up bigger, or zoom in on certain portions and maintain the quality, and megapixels does help with that. But the improvements that we are hearing about is that Apple would be focusing on upgrading the glass again, improving the image processing and the software. And as a matter of fact, a big one that, and I think this would be huge, is that Apple apparently has a patent application in place for improving the autofocus and also adding optical image stabilization to the camera sensors on a mobile device. So optical image stabilization would be a huge, huge deal and could really significantly, I think, improve the quality of images for the average user. I know I'm pretty shaky when I'm using a mobile device, so anything that could help stabilize my pictures, especially optically, that's going to be much better than anything they might be doing digitally. And I thought I'd just briefly mention the whole autofocus thing. I didn't really know this until recently. There is actually a autofocus mechanism and ring inside your iPhone, and you can actually hear it. This came up on a Maccast because I had a guy complain that he had to keep taking his iPhone back because it had a rattle. If he held it up to his ear and sort of shook it a little bit, he could hear it rattling in the camera lens, and he thought the camera lens was broken. What actually is happening in there is a little focus ring, and it's not engaged unless the mechanism is actually focusing the lens. So if you shake your phone and you put it right by your ear, especially if you put your ear right by the camera lens, you can hear the little mechanism, and it will actually loosen up over time. So don't worry if you have your phone like that. It's not broken. It's actually the little focusing ring inside that little tiny camera lens system that's going on there. And I had to research and ask a couple Apple engineers or iPhone, you know, folks that I knew who did repairs about this. And yeah, they actually explained it actually is in there. So if you look at this patent application with the autofocus and the optical image stabilization, you can see all these little tiny components and really intricate mechanisms that go into that lens system. And I think that's the right area for Apple to focus in. It'd be nice if they could get the low light performance also improved, continually improving that, because that seems to be where these smaller sensors tend to fall down a little bit. But Apple also, I think, is going to make some significant software improvements. And this week, reportedly, they acquired an app company, SnappyCam. And it's actually just one guy that they acquired. So they acquired a whole company, but it looks like to just grab the developer who made the software. Because what he had was an application that would let you take full resolution images on your iPhone, but snap 20 to 30 frames per second at much faster and quicker than Apple does in their own software. And unfortunately, when Apple acquired SnappyCam, the app is no longer available. So if you wanted the SnappyCam app, hopefully you had a copy of it already. I didn't even know about it. Otherwise, I would have probably picked one up, because that's impressive, 20 to 30 frames at full resolution. So the assumption is that Apple's acquiring the developer and the company so that they can roll this feature into a future version of iOS. And I would imagine also just to get the talents of a guy who can kind of figure out how to push the system that much, where he can get that much performance out of it. I mean, that's an engineer you want on your team. So I think that was a good pickup for Apple. But that just further sort of indicates that Apple's going to be focusing on improving the camera system in other areas, software and things like that, outside of just upping the megapixels on the sensor. We're continuing to hear more rumors about a larger 12-inch iPad, something a lot of people are calling the iPad Pro. And if you want to trust in supply chain sources, something that Tim Cook himself actually warned analysts against doing, he said, don't rely on those things too much. If you want to trust those sources, though, Evercore analyst Patrick Wang says that the 12-inch iPad is already in production. It could be on its way in here this fall. He said that it's going to be based on a quad-core A8 processor design, so that would be a next generation processor from Apple, upping the A7, and he expects it to be a hybrid device, something he's calling a hybrid device that would be targeted at the enterprise. I'm assuming by hybrid what's meant is something that would be a detachable keyboard, something more along the lines of a Surface Pro kind of competitor. But he sees that Apple would have a challenge in terms of storage, lack of storage sizes. He doesn't think 128 at the top end is going to be enough, that it'd need to be a little bit larger, and that even more a problem for Apple getting into the enterprise would be the lack of an official, I'm assuming he means Microsoft Office, kind of suite. Although I would argue that Pages on the iPad is a much better Office alternative than Office is on a Surface, at least what I tried out when I messed around with a Surface RT. I know that maybe I should be comparing the Pro, but I think the fact that Microsoft hasn't optimized Office for a touch interface puts them at a big disadvantage, where Apple has fully focused on making sure that Pages for iOS and Numbers and Keynote are all very much optimized for the touch interface. So you could imagine a 12-inch iPad with a really coolly designed and well-executed keyboard cover system, something that I think Apple could do a very good job of integrating and putting together, along with a very well-optimized software suite focused on Office applications. That could be a huge, huge deal. Although I think more people are looking at the 12-inch, the Mac Pro, as something that would appeal to designers and content creators, something more like an 11-inch MacBook Air re-envisioned as a post-PC tablet solution. And I think that's probably what Apple is really more going for, is something with more horsepower, probably more storage. I think that makes a lot of sense. I would think 32 would be the bottom line for an iPad Pro, and probably getting in the 256 range on the high end, maybe even 512, although that might be a bit overkill. Maybe they could do that as a build-to-order option. But it really becomes an interesting kind of product to think about. It also makes me start to think about, though, where does, if they do come out with a 12-inch iPad Pro, something that has a really cool keyboard system that works with it, where do you draw the line between, do I get an iPad Pro or do I get a MacBook Pro? And I guess it's the operating system and the software and the applications that you're going to run on it that becomes the distinguishing factor at that point. But things seem to be moving along for us getting some sort of larger iPad sometime in 2012. I think fall might be a little bit sooner than expected, although there have been, again, some supply chain reports that are saying Apple is in production. I personally am going to take Tim Cook's advice, though, and take those with a huge, huge grain of salt, because it seems a little bit too early for another iPad announcement. But Apple's surprised us before. Here's a really interesting announcement that came out this week. Digital music sales declined for the first time since Apple launched iTunes in 2003. That happened this week. According to Nielsen SoundScan numbers, they say sales of digital tracks fell from 1.34 billion units in 2012 to 1.26 billion units in 2013. That's a drop of about 5.7%. Album sales saw a very, very tiny decline, though. Digital album sales, just 0.1%. So hardly significant. So this was mostly digital track sales that fell. It didn't really surprise the industry, though, because they say the decline in sales was due to the rise in streaming services like RDO and Spotify, companies that they've been doing deals with. So the music executives said that, you know, those deals are actually going to offset and cut any of the losses that they might see from the drop in digital track sales. I just found that very, very interesting, because Apple has always been the company that has been out there saying, and Steve Jobs was classic for saying it, that they really believed that people wanted to own their music and not rent their music. And obviously, renting music is going to have an impact on digital track sales, sounding like the music industry isn't worrying about it too much. But I would think that there would be more profit in selling music than renting music. Some of the margins and things like that come from the music rental services seem incredibly small to me compared to the track sales and stuff like that. And more on my end, I worry about the content creators and the artists and those sorts of folks, you know, what kinds of money do they make? I think they make very, very little money from streaming, from everything that I've read and understand. So long term, this just doesn't seem like a viable, sustainable model, at least at the kinds of rates that are getting paid out. I guess if more and more artists can go direct to services like Spotify and RDO and maybe cut out the middle tiers, maybe they can make this work. But it was just very interesting. First time since 2003 that digital track sales have gone down. So Apple and iTunes had a pretty good run with selling tracks. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Digital Entertainment Group is reporting that digital movie sales are up significantly, 47% from 2012. Subscription streaming was also up 32%, so not as much as digital movie sales, which is very, very interesting. So less of us are, or I guess more people are buying movies on services like iTunes than are watching movies and content through streaming services. I have a feeling that this has something to do with the kinds of content that the movie studios are making available on services. I love Netflix streaming. I love streaming services. But I have to tell you, you know, very often the content falls short and I find myself just going and buying a movie. Also, on-demand rentals were up 6%. Kiosk rentals, physical disc sales, store rentals, and even disc subscription rentals, that would be like the physical discs that you get from iTunes or from Netflix, rather, those were all down significantly, according to the Digital Entertainment Group. And again, I don't think any of these trends are really surprising beyond the fact that more and more of us apparently are buying our movies. And I know I've been doing that. I've been talking about that on the MacCast for a few episodes now. I'm finding I'm buying more movies from iTunes. But I used to be a person who would buy DVDs. And I've just sort of changed that buying behavior. I'm really curious, and these numbers seem to indicate that more people are migrating to buying more digital movies and things like that through services like iTunes. So that's a good deal for Apple. And also apps are huge and continue to be huge. The App Store had a record-breaking year. Customers spent over $10 billion on apps and subscriptions in 2013, according to numbers from Apple. That's $1 billion, and $1 billion of that, rather, was spent in December alone. $1 billion of that $10 billion. So the sort of ramp up of app sales and profit from app sales is very, very steep and continues to be steep. As a matter of fact, Apple said total revenue paid out to developers was now at $15 billion, and the number that they had reported in January of last year was $7 billion. So since the inception of the App Store, through January of last year, they had paid out $7 billion. Just this year, they added another $8 billion in payout to developers. So you can see the kinds of growth that the App Store and the app explosion just continues to generate a lot of profits. And those are good numbers to hear and see. I really like hearing that, because that means there is revenue going out there, and significant amounts of revenue going out there to developers. And that means a good, healthy, sustainable environment, hopefully. You know, we got to, again, going back to what I was talking about earlier in the numbers, we got to dig into those numbers and figure out who's getting what of that $8 billion. But overall, it's a nice, healthy jump in that revenue. So happy to see those numbers come out from Apple this week. The next version of iOS is out to developers, the next beta, I should say. iOS 7 Beta 3 was sent out to developers. It has a number of updates and bug fixes, along with some very significant UI changes. A number of the blogs and sites started showing off the design changes, even though most of it's under NDA. The stuff gets out to us, you know, regardless, which I'm happy about, because I get to actually share it with you. The phone dialer is dramatically different. If you've seen or haven't seen the images of those, you should do some searching online. Basically, the call and end buttons have become completely circular. Also, the slide to shut off button, when you hold down the sleep wake button and go to power it off, that is completely circular in this little slider that goes across. It looks visually very, very different, and the cancel button is also in a circle. So Johnny Ive seems to be all about the flat circles now for a lot of the buttons and icons. Also, all of the green icons, the communication icons, so messages, the phone dialer, all those sorts of apps have been darkened up a little bit. They're not quite as bright. keyboard characters also are slightly bolder, so when you bring up the virtual keyboard or the on-screen keyboard, it's a little bit easier to read, also on a slightly darker background. And the shift and delete keys, the icons for those are now white on a dark gray key, where they used to just be outlines before. And there were also some updates to the music player. The shuffle and repeat buttons have a darker, brighter red background. They were kind of a pink before, and now they're red with white type. And it really gives it a more of a defined border, so I actually like it a lot better. Something that I haven't enjoyed about iOS 7 is all of the what I call quote-unquote buttons that aren't really buttons. It's just text, and it's not really obvious that you would click on that. It looks like it's just informative rather than interactive. And in case you're chomping at the bit waiting for iOS 7.1, the update, you probably want to cool your jets a little bit. Either that or join the developer program, because according to Boy Genius Report, they say their sources are telling them that the beta still has a lot of testing and bugs that need to be squashed. They don't expect iOS 7.1 to reach consumers till sometime in March. And I know a lot of people really want the new update because, frankly, iOS 7.0.x, 4, 3, whatever you have, has been a little bit buggy, especially with the app and Springboard crashes. I was on Mac Break Weekly this week, and we talked about that a little bit. I personally noticed less with 7.04, but I still get them, you know, a couple times a week, which can be really annoying. So hopefully Apple will take care of that part of it in the latest update. But certainly, a lot of us moving to iOS 7. The adoption rate on iOS 7 has been astounding, according to Apple's own numbers. They say that iOS 7 is stealing away share from iOS 6 at about 1% per week now. So adding 1% more people converting every week to iOS 7. The latest data looking at a 7-day period on the App Store, basically iPhones and devices accessing the App Store, they say that iOS 7 now accounts for 78% of all iOS devices. That's up from 74% at the beginning of December, so added another 4% just in a single month. And just for comparison, Cult of Mac mentions that only 1.1% of Android devices are currently running the latest version of that operating system, Android KitKat. So Apple is doing a very good job of getting people to upgrade to the latest operating system. You know, and that's a benefit that comes from having that closed ecosystem, right? And being able to control the hardware and the software and really integrate that together. But that's a big advantage for not just for consumers, but even more so for developers who have a much easier time being able to target a single operating system, you know, knowing that a majority of your users are going to be on the same OS and being able to take advantage, especially of a lot of the new features and functionality that is rolled into that OS and bring that into your app. That makes happy developers, and happy developers make a great platform with lots of great apps, and that makes happy customers. So, you know, it's really good all the way around. So it turns out that making a product that does not exist is a really tricky thing. I'm talking about the rumored iWatch. There's been a couple sources this week, including DigiTimes, that say that Apple's production of the iWatch is delayed. And I find that interesting because I don't think Apple is quite at the point of producing an iWatch, but some of the sources seem to believe that they are. The issues being reported seem to be the finish of the actual device itself, so actually getting certain kinds of finishes to adhere to the finished product or just be good enough for Apple's standards. Reportedly, they had to shut down advanced prototyping of the watch at least at one unspecified manufacturer late in 2013. Apple is reportedly working with Quanta Manufacturing as the manufacturing partner for the Apple iWatch, according to sources. They also reportedly lost a key player on the iWatch product, which is supposedly also adding to the delays. Brian James, who was Apple's iPod software director, has been acquired by Nest. That's Tony Fadell's company, the Apple employee who is considered by many to be the father of the iPod. He went and formed Nest, the smart thermostat company, and they now manufacture actually the smart smoke detector, the Nest Protect. So Brian James supposedly got hired by them last February. Bloomberg claimed that Apple had at least a 100-person team working on their iWatch product. And we have also had indications since then that they've been aggressively hiring engineers and designers to work on that team. Also, many recent acquisitions of new companies and technologies by Apple would have applications in the wearables space. So I don't doubt that Apple is actually working on a wearable product. I'm just questioning the time frame. As far as what else is delaying production of the iWatch, supposedly display and battery issues have also been cited as major hurdles. Apple supposedly targeting a 4 to 5 day battery life between charges on the device, and it's supposed to have just a 100 milliamp hour battery, so that would be very challenging indeed. Also, there's been a rumor that the iWatch will have an OLED display, something that Apple has not put in a product before, so they could be having some issues with that as well. But you know, it's hard to make smart devices. And even Samsung CEO told Walt Mossberg recently, he's started up a new blogging, I guess, or technology blog called Recode. And the CEO of Samsung said in an interview for that site that smartwatches are really hard to do, and battery life is one of those really, really challenging pieces. And I don't doubt that when you're making that small of a device, but there's also a big challenge when you don't have a market, when you don't have a reason for your product being. And I just feel that Apple knows that there's not a place for that kind of device. And until they can develop and figure out a market, they're not really going to be moving into production. So likely what's going on now is just a lot of prototyping, development, playing around with different ideas. And they could be struggling and working through issues in that regard, but I hardly think it's anything that is quote-unquote production issues. But that's really just my two cents. It's my opinion. We are hearing the rumors, so maybe there's some truth to them, maybe not. I no doubt that Apple is working on some sort of wearable products, but I'm expecting to see those hitting the marketplace maybe at the end of this year, sometime in the fall timeframe, right before the holidays. And in case you ever thought that there was any doubt that Apple products have a halo effect, there's some new numbers out this week that show that roughly two-thirds of Windows PC owners now own an Apple product. This is according to a Morgan Stanley research estimate. The report indicates that Apple products have been rapidly adopted by Windows customers. In 2010, just 30% seemed to own an Apple product compared to 70% in their most recent survey. So that is amazing. In just 3 years, to go from 30% to 70%. So certainly Apple technology has broad appeal beyond just us Mac fans. Unfortunately, the piece didn't break out which specific products or devices Windows users are flocking to, but we can pretty much, I think, assume that it's going to be an iPod, iPhone, iPad, and maybe just a Mac or two sprinkled in for those folks who are sliders. Remember that term? We used to talk about that on the MacCast in the past. Those are those of us who work in a Windows world and a Mac world at the same time, moving seamlessly between both systems. I think that was a term that our friend Victor Cahiao came up with way back in the day on some of the podcasts we were talking about, and sort of adopted it. And I know there's a lot of folks out there that are in that camp, and probably, well, now even more so, you've got a lot of folks that are using iPads and iPhones along with their PC devices. With that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. I caught a piece, I think it was over on the unofficial Apple weblog, that I thought was great, commenting or talking about Reading List, which is a feature built into Safari. And I have to admit, I don't use it all that frequently, but it is a really cool feature and something that is built in. I think I don't use it because I'm a little bit baffled by it. I'm not sure exactly how to use it because it feels in some ways like bookmarks a little bit, but it's really kind of bookmarks on steroid. It more equates to being similar to something like Pocket or Instapaper. And I just frankly often forget to use it, or when I do use it, I forget that I did, and I forget to go back and review the articles. I still prefer Pocket, but I think it's a neat feature and wanted to mention how you can use it and leverage it in Mac OS X. So it's pretty simple. It exists both on Safari on the Mac and Safari on your iOS devices. Pretty easy to add an article or a something you're reading to reading list. And the idea is that you come across a piece, something while you're surfing the web, and you want to save it for later, maybe come back and review it. But maybe you don't want to set up a whole entire bookmark. You know, it's something you're going to come back, you're going to read once, and then maybe archive off. Maybe you'll come back to it again another time, but it's not something that is like a permanent bookmark that would live in your bookmark bar. So to access it on iOS, all you have to do is tap the share icon, and then there's a little add to reading list button. It actually has a little pair of Steve Jobs looking glasses attached to it. Interestingly, the icon is different on the desktop. And then once you've added an article to your reading list on iOS, to get back and review it, you just tap the bookmarks icon in the toolbar, and then again tap on the reading list tab. On the Mac, it's very, very similar. On the toolbar, there is a, you can click the share icon, and there is an add to reading list button. There it has more sort of Ray-Ban Wayfarer kind of sunglasses as the glasses. I don't know why. Hopefully they'll bring the Steve Jobs glasses over to the Mac desktop. And again, I'm not on Mountain Lion on my main system yet, so maybe I just missed that and it's been updated in Mountain Lion. But so you click on that, you click add to reading list, or you can go under the bookmark menu and there's an add to reading list option. The keyboard shortcut for it is Command Shift D. If you're interested. And then to access the articles on your Mac, same kind of thing. You access the bookmark icon from the bookmarks bar, or go under bookmarks and choose show bookmarks. And then in the bookmarks sidebar, there's a little reading list tab and you can view the items. And if you're using iCloud, the reading list will sync across all your devices. So if you add something to your reading list on your iOS device, it'll be there on your Mac when you go to access it. And then you can click on the articles and they will pop back up. And what's really cool is that they will be archived for offline reading. So if you're on your iOS device, you're maybe in an airport, going to get on an airplane, you can throw a bunch of articles and things you want to read into your reading list. It will download offline copies of those, and then you'll be able to access them offline. And another thing that I find very handy, which is another feature that's built into Safari that I often forget about, is the reader feature. And this gives you just a straight up text, unencumbered view of the article or content. So you can get it without all the sidebars and ads and things like that. You just get the article and the images in a really nice format. You can change the font and all that sort of thing. Sort of gives you this heads-up view of the entire article. So to use the reader feature in Safari on the Mac, you just click the little blue reader button in the URL sidebar. You'll see it pop up there on the right. You can also go under the view menu and use the reader option. So view reader, Command-Shift-R is the keyboard shortcut. And then on iOS 7, it's the three little lines that are to the left of the URL bar that are the reader feature. So if you tap on those, you'll get the article full screen on your iOS device. And then once you've read an item that you've added to your reading list, it will be automatically archived. On Mac Safari, I don't see any indicators that seem to show whether you've read an article or not. It'll still appear in your reading list, even though it's marked as an archive. The only way I could figure out how to see that it was marked as an archive is if you right-click on the item in the list, it will have a mark as unread option instead of a mark as read option. You can also clear items that are in your reading list on the Mac by hovering over them and clicking on the little close X icon if you want to delete them and get them out of your reading list completely. On iOS, the read articles actually disappear from your reading list, and there's a little show all option in the menu reading list at the bottom of the reading list if you want to bring that back up. So if you tap on show all, it will actually bring back those archived options. And then to delete items out of your reading list, you just swipe across them to the left, and then you can access the little delete option to get them out of there. But reading lists is a pretty cool feature, and if you're not using it in Safari on the Mac, you might, or on the Mac or iOS, you might give it a shot. Adrian emailed me, and he is a Mac user, also a gamer, and as such, one of the limits that I think a lot of gamers reach or often talk about with Macs is that, you know, sort of Apple picks your graphics card for you, and in most models, you're actually stuck with it because it's integrated into the motherboard. So you really have a non-upgradable GPU video card and graphics. And a lot of gamers like the ability to upgrade to the latest and greatest, most powerful graphics cards. Just like computers, they're getting upgraded constantly, and new games want the latest and greatest technology. They take advantage of the latest and greatest technology. So a common complaint against Mac systems as gaming systems has always been that, hey, you can't upgrade the GPU. But now that we have Thunderbolt, there's a lot of external Thunderbolt chassis out there, and they give you the ability to add PCI expansion cards into a breakout box that sits outside your Mac and connect that up to Thunderbolt. So in a way, it kind of gives a Thunderbolt system a way to have PCI expansion. It can be used potentially to give an aging Mac better gaming performance. But the question from Adrian, and something I didn't know about till I did the research, is this even viable? Is it something that's even worth doing? And Sonnets actually makes an expansion chassis. I had a chance to talk to them at the Mac Tech conference a little bit, and they don't position the expansion chassis as something for expanding the options, the built-in graphics options on a Mac. They focus more on the applications in high-end video markets, video capture, some of the other things, building in, you know, putting in PCI cards for really high-end RAID systems, things like that. But they do have the Echo Express line, and the Echo Express Pro, for example, gives you two 16x full-length PCIe cards, and you can fit either a single width card or two single width cards, excuse me, or a double width card. A lot of the higher-end Pro graphics cards are dual width cards, so you could get one of those and you could drop a dual width, really high-end beefy graphics card in there. So it does, it just because they don't recommended or talk about it doesn't mean that it's not possible. It actually is possible, but there are some significant differences that you need to know about from a technology standpoint versus actually, you know, mounting a PCIe card directly to a motherboard expansion slot, say on a PC or on the older Mac Pro systems. And really what it comes down to is channels and sort of lanes of throughput. So for one, the number of channels that are supported over Thunderbolt is going to be different than the channels that are supported natively when you're plugging a PCIe card into the expansion slot on the motherboard. The Thunderbolt controller actually consists of two bidirectional data channels. Each channel contains an input and an output lane. And then the Thunderbolt chips that are actually on the ends of the Thunderbolt cables, they will take both DisplayPort 1.1 and a four-lane PCIe 2.0 bus. This is for Thunderbolt 1. We'll get to Thunderbolt 2 in a second, but let's just stick with Thunderbolt 1 for now. And so each one of those two channels is independent, and they can carry a DisplayPort signal or a PCIe, but not both. So in each direction, each channel has a theoretical maximum throughput of 10 gigabits per second. That's the same as two lanes of PCIe 2.0. And remember, the Thunderbolt cable has two channels. So two channels, two lanes, that gives you essentially what amounts to four-lane PCIe 2.0 if you're not carrying DisplayPort at the same time over that cable. So if you're using both channels, no display, you're going to get the equivalent of a four-channel PCIe 2.0, basically what would amount to a 4x PCIe slot in terms of throughput through the Thunderbolt cable back into your Mac. But if your Mac only has a single Thunderbolt port, you might need to also connect your display to that Thunderbolt port, right? Your DisplayPort display. So at that point, you're really at 2x. So that's still 10 gigabits per second bidirectional per channel, the theoretical maximum of Thunderbolt. And I did see a bunch of benchmarks recently, and it seems like you can eke out pretty much the full throughput on Thunderbolt. A lot of the benchmarks when they're hooking up RAID systems are 800 to 950 megabytes per second pushing through the Thunderbolt connector. So that's saturating that 10 gigabit per second channel. So you can get that throughput. But if you've been listening closely, here's that technical limitation, right? You can have an expansion chassis like the Sonnets one that can, you can insert a 16x, basically a 16 channel PCIe card into the expansion chassis. But once it hits that Thunderbolt, you're throttling it down to a 4-channel PCIe 2.0. And that's only if you don't have a display hooked up. If you have a display hooked up, then you're down to 2X or a 2-channel PCIe. Now, some are going to say, well, Thunderbolt 2 is coming and that doubles it. And you're right. That's going to give you a 4X PCIe or 4 PCIe lanes on a single channel. So if you have a monitor and you're running the Thunderbolt across that, then you're the PCIe across that, you're going to get 4X. If you can set, if you can use a dedicated cable, say you have two Thunderbolt ports, you can put your display on one Thunderbolt controller and your expansion card on another, then you're going to get the full 8X out of that, right? So it can be done. There's some technical limitations, but really what we need to know is, does it matter? Is it really going to affect performance of your gaming system? And it likely depends on, I think, where you're starting at, and even probably then, very little from the information that I can glean, you know, searching around the internet. So say, for example, you're running a MacBook Air with Intel integrated graphics, maybe the Intel HD 3000 graphics. Then heck yeah, even putting it into an expansion chassis, the high-end graphics card or mid to higher-end range graphics card, and running it through that Thunderbolt is going to give you an amazing boost in performance. As a matter of fact, Tom's Hardware did some testing with an AMD Radeon HD 9670 and also an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 460. They plugged those into a Sonnet expansion chassis and ran some benchmarks and basically compared the Thunderbolt connected performance versus native performance in benchmark scores when connected directly to a PCIe slot. And what they found was that the Thunderbolt benchmarks came in about 10 to 20% lower than the natively connected cards. So even though it's throttled down in terms of the channels that it's going across, it's still performing pretty well. You're not getting as much loss as you would think using less channels. I don't know technically why it comes out that way, but that's sort of what their numbers showed. As a matter of fact, they compared the native performance of the MacBook Air with its integrated graphics versus the graphics in the expansion chassis, and basically it was a 13 times increase. So for running games like Battlefield 3 or Warcraft at high levels, you know, with everything kind of cranked up, they were still able to get frame rates of 40 to 50 frames per second on the expansion card inside the chassis versus 4 to 8 frames per second on the native GPU that's built into the Air. So that's a huge, huge improvement. Now, if you have a higher end Mac, if you have the new Mac Pro with those dual Fire Pro cards, it's not going to be nearly as great of a boost. I would argue at this point, probably not much at all. I guess depending upon what kind of graphics cards you're talking about, but it's going to be, you know, as a percentage wise, I think negligible. But the key here is that you get a few years down the road and those Fire Pro cards might not be state of the art. They might not be top of the line. And so if you want to eke some additional juice out of your system, then maybe going with an expansion chassis is going to give you a little bit more longevity, a little more life. It's nice to know that you have an option and that you may be able to gain some benefits. That said, the other thing that factors into sort of doing an upgrade with an expansion chassis is going to be that you might have a bit more tinkering to do than you would if you had native graphics support built into the Mac, right? You're going to have to deal with compatibility and drivers and kind of getting everything to work, finding the right cards. You're going to have to do some research. You're going to have to check out the expansion chassis, make sure that it supports the cards that you're going for and that it's going to work with all those games that you want to run. So you need to kind of go in with your eyes open and know what you're getting into. But as far as, is it technically possible? Yes. Is it worthwhile? I would say maybe, depending upon your situation. And, you know, it's good that we have those sorts of options with Thunderbolt. But is it going to match the native performance? If you're getting into a war of words with your PC building, you know, high-end gaming system PC friends, they're going to win. You know, natively attaching the card to the motherboard on a 16X PCIe slot is going to be better just in terms of performance because it's not going to have the overhead that the Thunderbolt is going to have, and it's not going to have the bottlenecks that the Thunderbolt is going to have. Real world wise, what's the difference? I think it's much smaller than they probably will want you to believe. And you could maybe come back at them with that. But, you know, as far as is it something worth looking into or worth considering, Adrian? Yeah, I think do a little bit of research, see if it's going to meet your needs. And it is a nice option. If you got a new Apple TV over the holidays, or even if you just have an Apple TV and you want to get a little more out of it, I came across a link to a cool thread over on Reddit. I know Reddit has gotten pretty popular. I don't hang out there too much, but a lot of people hang out on Reddit and they share ideas, and a bunch of people were asking in a thread, what are some tips for new Apple TV owners that people have? And there's some cool stuff in there. And so I thought I'd mention a couple of my favorites, but I'll have a link to the full thread in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. One that I didn't know about, or maybe if I did know about, I completely forgot, is if you hold down the menu button on your remote, when you're deep down in the menu, so if you've drilled down, you know, into a section, you can hold down the menu button and it will jump right back to the main screen. So rather than having to keep clicking the menu button over and over, if you just press and hold it, it'll jump right back. Also, holding up the playback button, or holding the playback button rather, during a movie will show you information about the video. Also, holding the select button during playback will give you options for accessing chapters and subtitles and audio options and your speaker output. So if you want to change from the built-in speakers to maybe a set of AirPlay speakers, something like that, you can do that. In Netflix, and also maybe in some other apps, pressing play instead of select when you're on an item in the summary episode list view will play it directly. So rather than having to drill down a second level, which is what I always do, you know, I'll be browsing through and click on something and drill down until I can get to the screen where I can hit play. If you're on that just list of all the different shows, just hitting play right when you have it selected will, I guess, jump right to it. If you press and hold the select button on the main screen of your Apple TV, you can actually get the little icons to wiggle like they do on an iOS device, and you can select them and you can move them around the screen and you can reorganize them, which is very convenient. But an even more powerful feature in my mind, and something that I think a lot of people don't know about, is you can hide some of the channels that you don't use or you don't access. So if you go into your settings, into general, under restrictions, you don't have to turn the restrictions on, but if you scroll down a bit, you'll see you'll have options to toggle hiding or showing the individual channels. So if you don't use that Crunchyroll anime channel, or maybe you don't use the new Korean TV channel, you can turn those off and you don't have to see them on your main screen. And if you ever want to turn them back on, just come back in here and turn them back on. There were a few recommendations for an application that a lot of people had told me about and really like, an app called iFlix that's available on the Mac App Store. And it's main thing that most people tell me about it is that it can go out and clean up and add metadata to your iTunes content so that when it's displayed on your Apple TV, it shows up better, especially for any content that you've brought in yourself, any DVDs and things like that you've ripped. Apparently, it'll also transcode media if you need that. Personally, I've never used it, but I've had enough people tell me about it, and it popped up enough in this Reddit article that I think I'm safe in probably recommending it. So if you're looking for something to clean up your metadata in your iTunes library, check out iFlix. I think it's about $20 US on the Mac App Store. You can also press and hold the play pause button on the main screen of your Apple TV if you want to put it to sleep immediately, so rather than waiting for it to naturally go to sleep. And then another one that I recommend people do, especially if you have Macs in the same room as your Apple TV that have IR ports on them, is make sure that you go in and you pair your remote. So go under settings, go under remote, and pair the remote. That basically locks the remote to the Apple TV and makes it so that that remote can only control the Apple TV and no other devices. I often get people who email me and they say, I was using the remote with my Apple TV and my Mac started playing audio, or my Mac started doing weird things. Alternatively, you can also just disable the IR port on your Mac. So that's what I do on all my Macs. I don't think I ever have used the infrared port on my Mac laptop. And if you go into System Preferences on your Mac, under Security and Privacy, under General, and then click on the little advanced button down at the bottom, there's a checkbox that says disable remote infrared remote control infrared receiver. Just check that on, and you'll no longer have to worry about an infrared remote controlling your Mac. But some cool Apple TV tips over there at Reddit, and again, I'll have a link to them in the show notes at maccast.com. Here's another really cool tip that I found over on the unofficial Apple weblog. I think this one was from Steve Sandy. I like Steve. He's a really nice guy and really smart, and he often has these cool tips. There was this cool little video tip about accessing Apple's Wi-Fi diagnostics to kind of help improve the quality of the Wi-Fi signal on your home network. I didn't even know that the Wi-Fi diagnostic thing existed, but if you hold down the Option key when you click on the wireless icon in your menu bar, down at the bottom of the dropdown, you will see an open wireless diagnostics option. If you click on that, you will be prompted to enter your admin username and password. Enter that, and then a little wizard will pop up. And what you could do with that is you can use that to run through and check your network. If you do it, it doesn't really give you any information. After it's finished, it just gives you some additional options. It gives you an option to monitor your Wi-Fi connection or continue on to a summary. And if you continue on to the summary, it will generate this massive gzip file that has all kinds of logs and data and really cryptic information in it. So I believe what the wireless diagnostics tool is for is mainly if you called up AppleCare and you were having wireless or connectivity issues, they would have you run this thing and then send them the log files so they could sort of analyze what's going on your Mac. But what Steve found out and pointed out in his thing is that if you ignore the wizard, so when the wizard pops up, just ignore that thing and go under the window menu and you can choose utilities. And from there, you'll get this little dialog that has a bunch of tabs that, again, look like they're mostly for data collection and logging, but there's some interesting ones in there. There's a Wi-Fi scan tab that allows you to click scan now, and when you do that, it will show you data for all the Wi-Fi networks that are near you, and you can get a bunch of information on them, and yours, if you want to know which network you're connected to and see sort of the stats for that, that will appear as bold in the list. Also, there is a performance tab, and clicking on that, you get a bunch of active graphs that are going to show you like signal to noise ratio and the signal strength for the network that you are connected to. And then in the info tab, there's all kinds of data about the Wi-Fi that you're on, including which band you're using. So if you wanted to know, am I connected at 2.4 or 5 gigahertz on my 802.11n connection, you can see that. And there's also in that info dialog box recommended channels. And that was sort of the tip that Steve was giving is if you've ever gone into your airport settings and you know you can either have it automatically pick the channel that you're connected to, or you can manually put those things in. If you've ever wondered, what should I put in? This can kind of give you a little hint. You can look at the recommended channels for the band that you're connected to, and you could manually tweak those in your airport settings, potentially improving the quality and reliability of your Wi-Fi connection. I'm perfectly fine to let it stay on automatic. I tend to not have issues, but if you want to play around with this, it's a cool little utility, and it was nice of Steve over at the unofficial Apple blog to point it out for us. And then lastly today, I had Larry write in with a question that I get asked about a lot, and it has to do with the Mac App Store, and App Store updates. Larry said he went in, he updated all of his apps in the Mac App Store. I think he got an alert saying, hey, you have updates available. Goes to the update tab, runs updates, everything runs fine, it's all done, and then he notices it's still telling him he has updates available. So he relaunches the Mac App Store, and lo and behold, the apps that he just updated are still being noted as requiring updating. And it puts you into this sort of vicious cycle, and you keep upgrading, and it keeps telling you that you have to update. And that can get really annoying. So the question is, what gives? What's going on there? Well, it might be other issues, but the most common thing that I've discovered is that, Larry, you're a victim of probably following my advice on doing backups, meaning that you have a clone backup, you're using Time Machine, you have some sort of attached drive on your Mac, and the thing is that drive has copies of your applications. The copies probably before you ran the update, because if it hasn't kicked off updating, if you haven't done your next scheduled clone backup, then guess what? It hasn't updated those applications. And the thing that compounds this is that the Mac App Store uses Spotlight indexing to know which apps are installed and to notify you on which ones need updating. So what happens is that you've updated the ones that are locally on your Mac drive, but the ones that are on your backup drives are still the older versions, and both versions of the apps are in your Spotlight index. So the App Store is picking up on the ones that are in your cloned backups and telling you that you need to update them. And Larry even noted that if he just waits a couple days, it'll eventually sort of clear itself up and he won't see those updates anymore. Well, guess what? That's because probably your backups ran as scheduled, and now the versions on your Mac and the versions in your backup are both up to date. So the App Store is not complaining anymore. So to sort of fix this issue, you really have two options. The first one, and I think the best one, is to go in and just exclude the applications folder on your backup volume from the Spotlight indexing. And that's actually what I do. As a matter of fact, I completely exclude my entire cloned backup drive from Spotlight indexing. So to do that, you go into the System Preferences, you go under Spotlight, click on the Privacy tab, and then click the little plus button at the bottom, and then just simply select the folder or drive that you want to exclude from the index. So in your case, this would be the Applications folder on your Carbon Copy Cloner or your Time Machine backup. And once you've done that, you shouldn't be plagued by this problem any longer. The other option would be to not include your applications folder in your backups. So just selectively exclude the applications folder from backup. Now, this is really only viable if you know that you have copies of all your applications, or that you can get copies of all your applications back if you need to reinstall or rebuild your Mac for some reason. And you don't want to be, you know, you want to lose the ability basically to do the whole Migration Assistant restore from, say, your Time Machine backup. Because if you exclude those applications from your backup, obviously, when you restore from your clone or you restore from Time Machine, those aren't going to come back, and you're going to have to manually reinstall your apps. So I really probably wouldn't go that route. I'd go the route of just excluding from Spotlight, but there's a couple options for you, and I think that should clean up your app update frustrations. So with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone or iPod. Also check out PDF Pen Scan Plus, one of my favorite applications. Also TextExpander Touch for your iOS devices. So you can get TextExpander in a bunch of your favorite applications. You can get more information and details on all the Smile software by going to smilesoftware.com. And I'd also like to thank Gazelle. It's the fast and easy way to sell your used gadgets online. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth simply by going to gazelle.com and getting an offer today. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. If you have any questions for me, a comment, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can check those out on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a MacCast Google Plus community. If that's your preferred venue, just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find it. But that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.